Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now, on Last Call, a nasty bite. The government going after Apple. One of the state attorneys general behind it will join us on what comes next. Liftoff, Reddit soaring in its public debut. Is an IPO rush back on the menu? Leaving tech behind. What a mighty hot streak for the small caps. They finally kick in overdrive, kicking in the door. A huge housing market surprise is a lot more than meets the eye. Plus, the wild scandal engulfing baseball's highest paid star, and the plot could soon thicken. All that and more over the hour, so batter up, because Last Call is up right now. Well, good evening here. Good afternoon out west. I'm Brian Sullivan. Got all that and more coming up in our hour. But first up on Last Call, it was yet another record day for your money. The Dow, S&P, NASDAQ, all closing at record highs. And by the way, you've also got a nice little four-day win streak going. And maybe get the hats ready. The Dow creeping closer to that big old 40,000 mark. May not get there, but it's at 39,781. But even as stocks surge, take heed. We are seeing more and more mixed signals from the consumer and corporate America. All right, first up, the quote-unquote good news tonight, and that is FedEx, up 13%. Investors love their guidance. But maybe the not-so-good news, Nike, going the other way. Its sales outlook, not as good as what some investors apparently wanted. It's down 6%. Same with Lululemon. That stock squeezed after reporting sluggish sales growth. It's down 11%. This has kind of been the trend lately. Outside, really, of sort of AI-related companies, industrials, or energy, more consumer-focused companies have kind of been riding that razor's edge lately. Not saying something bad's going to happen to the market, but it is just something to keep in mind as we hit record after record. So let's talk about it and what it may be saying, if anything. And joining us to kick off the show tonight is CIC Wealth Management exec and CBC contributor Malcolm Etheridge, and StoneX chief market strategist Catherine Rooney Vera. Malcolm, I feel like every night we're kind of saying, well, this company and the consumer missed, or this company's laying people off, and yet stocks just continue to make record highs.
Yeah, Brian, I think that the most important thing is that the Fed came out and told us, basically reassured us, that regardless of whether cuts happen in May, June, or July, we are going to see three by year end, and everything else doesn't matter. So whether the consumer is feeling a little bit stretched, especially for high dollar retail like Nike and Lulu, it doesn't necessarily matter for the broader markets, because all we've been focused on to this point, at least, is when is the Fed going to cut, not whether the Fed will cut.
Catherine, you agree that that's kind of all that really matters? I mean, I hate being so tied to the Fed, but maybe Malcolm's right.
Well, it's what matters to the market. But the question is, if in fact these headwinds turn into, you know, reality, we've been expecting the consumer to pull back for some time, then the story changes. So I think that the market is really discounting the perfect landing that Powell had doubled down on from December's pivot party. This was like pivot party part two. But if you look at some numbers, you know, I'm talking to Mike Green tomorrow. Non-mortgage personal interest outlays are exploding higher. This is rent, food, gasoline, non-mortgage personal income payments as a percentage of total income. That's all moving higher. We're talking like 41% of total income. So people are going to start pulling back here, and we're already seeing it. We heard from Darden's chief executive officer saying that the lower income consumer is already starting to pull back. We've seen it in Olive Garden's numbers. So I think that there are headwinds here, and I think that there are underpriced risks in the market that, to me, Brian, I've said this on your show before, it just makes perfect sense to me to at least take out some form of life insurance policy and hedge your bets with inexpensive options cash, you know, T-bills. I think the Fed is going to cut. It's going to be minimally, probably 50 basis points, maybe 75 basis points. But that's going to keep cash interesting, gold interesting, and I think defensive sectors as well as put options.
Catherine, quickly back to you. Talk about that insurance in sort of layman's terms, right? It's last call, right? We're not all market pros here. What do we do? Buy some out-of-the-money put option on the S&P 500 for 6 months out?
You can buy an at-the-money put option at 4.5%, thereabouts, that covers you 12 months out. And yes, that caps your upside, but at least it protects your downside in the event that we do see a culmination of headwinds really hitting the U.S. consumer, which is an underpriced risk at this point.
Yeah, because Malcolm, that's kind of my worry, right? And, you know, our job here at this side of the desk and your side, too, with clients is kind of to worry, even as things sure. do well, because what if we get another red hot inflation number and suddenly those three rate cuts become two or they become one? And if we are so beholden to the Federal Reserve cutting rates for stocks to go up, well, if we don't get the rate cuts, I think you see where I'm going.
I do. And I think you made the case that small caps finally had their day in the sun after a few days of kind of just hanging out in no man's land. And that's the part that concerns me the most as far as higher for longer, right? If inflation does decide to double back the way we're concerned it might, it's really going to have an impact on the small and mid-cap sector. So the broadening that we're talking about may leave them behind, because higher for longer impacts those companies that have to borrow to grow. Your large companies, especially your mega-cap techs, might be immune. But in that smaller sector, you know, half the Russell 2000 isn't even profitable, right? So every month that Powell decides to keep rates higher, those floating rate loans they depend on to make payroll get that much harder to continue to keep.
So you think that's why, Malcolm, that small caps have really been outperforming in the last couple of months, because they are super reliant on interest rates and the Fed?
That's right. I think the market is basically placing its bet, trying to get ahead of where the puck is going, so to speak, and make sure that when those cuts come, they're in place for that run that inevitably happens in, you know, the Russell 2000, for example. But yeah. I'm more concerned, to Catherine's point, about the opposite scenario where those cuts take a lot longer to come. And if you don't have that insurance policy, you're kind of just standing in the way trying to catch that falling knife.
And for the next segment, not this one, we got to go, guys. We're probably one Houthi missile away that hits a U.S. or U.K. destroyer from potentially a full-on war with Iran, and nobody seems to care. Catherine Rivera, Malcolm Etheridge, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so we just showed you the macro markets. Let's take a look under the hood as we do your best and worst in the S&P 500 today. The best, we talked about it last night, Micron blowing away estimates. Investors were rewarded today. On the flip side, Accenture crushed after cutting its forecast for the year, saying that overall IT spending could slow. Think about that. That stock fell 9%. All right. We are just getting going. And up next, Reddit roaring in its public debut. Has the forum for the meme stocks become a meme stock itself? New data you're going to want to see, and only we'll see here on Last Call.
Welcome to the Canva guided meditation for stress at work. Impending deadline? Generate Canva presentations in seconds.
So fast.
Brainstorm got too big? Ooh. Summarize with AI in a click. Click, click, click. Writer's block? Release with Canva Magic Write.
Magical.
Stress less and save time at canva.com. Designed for work.
Canva. This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
All right, welcome back. Maybe your biggest big money story today is Reddit. Reddit blasting past its $34 IPO price of, well, 34 to close above 50 bucks. That, my friends, a 48% gain and values Reddit at about $9.5 billion. Right now, our DDT is slightly down after hours. But Reddit is not the only IPO that had investors kind of foaming at the mouth this week. Data center company Astera Labs has seen its shares jump 78% in 2 days. Some very good news for the market for new stocks. So let's talk about it all, Astera, Reddit, and more with Yannick Malling. He is the co-CEO and co-founder of investing app Public. So, Yannick, welcome back. You and Public, you get to see data on what investors, what traders are doing. What did you see on Reddit's first day?
So despite only trading for actually less than half a day, because they were a little bit delayed there at the open, it was the most bought stock of the day. You've also seen the anticipation build in the past few weeks, right? The way we see this is like you can see it in the search volumes. We have Alpha, our research assistant, AI research assistant, where people are asking questions about Alpha, how's the company doing, all kinds of questions. And so it was a big day for Reddit. Now, we didn't see it memeing as some people had maybe anticipated, but I would also say keep in mind the options market, as he was just talking about, has not formed around the Reddit stock yet. And so at this point, you can only buy the equity. And a lot of options traders on Public were asking about Reddit today. When might we be able to buy options on it? And I think it's going to be next week, maybe
Monday.
As soon as Monday.
Yeah, I think Monday at the NASDAQ. I'm not sure if it's in the morning or maybe it's later on in the day, but you can answer that question. It is going to be on Monday. And then so, and again, in layman's terms, last call, right? It's 7 o'clock, whatever it is here. What would options on Reddit mean? What does that mean for Public? What does that mean for the equity?
So I think the reason it's specifically maybe important for Reddit is, as you might know, options are sort of the preferred instrument of choice for many traders in the forum known as Wall Street Bets, which everybody have been talking about, obviously, all week or all month. And so I would be surprised if we didn't see some options action in this name next week. Now, whether they're going to buy calls or puts, that's been the question that's been on everybody's mind, especially all day, and we'll find out next week.
Yeah, I think we will. Astera Labs, another AI play, and not a company I'm familiar with at all, but I do know, thanks to a guy named Yannick Malling, maybe you've heard of him, that the word AI is used 50 times in the filing for Reddit going public. I haven't looked at Astera, but I got to imagine it's probably about the same. I mean, is that where we are, Yannick? You just got to throw AI in your S1 or in your earnings and the market loves you.
It certainly doesn't hurt at this point, I would say. I mean, I think a big part of the run-up you've seen in the markets have been due to AI. Retail investors are definitely very excited about AI. And I think retail investors, you've seen it over and over. They kind of like these mega trends and super cycles, right? Whether it was COVID stocks in 2020, EVs in 2021, right now the mega trend is AI. And so Reddit is an interesting one because it doesn't have a lot of AI revenue actually yet, but it did obviously just come out with that Google deal. I think only a month ago it was announced actually. And so I think that's seen by many as a great proof of concept, and that gives them hopes that that this company can fare a little bit better than if it was simply sort of the community and the advertising revenue that you were investing in for the future kind of decades.
Well, 19 years after being founded by the very youthful Sam Huffman and Alexis Ohanian, Reddit making a lot of investors and employees, hopefully, rich. Yannick Malling of Public, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, still ahead. Upsetting the Apple cart, an historic antitrust suit rocking the tech giant. California State Attorney General helping lead the charge will join us with what this is really all about.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Canva. All right, welcome back. It wasn't just about Reddit today. Another huge money story is Apple. The Federal Department of Justice and 16 states suing Apple on antitrust grounds. They basically say the iPhone illegally maintains a monopoly on smartphones, restricting access to developers and engaging in anti-competitive behavior. Here's U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland earlier today.
Today, Apple's share of the U.S. performance smartphone market exceeds 70%. Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market. We allege that Apple has employed a strategy that relies on exclusionary, anti-competitive conduct that hurts both consumers and developers.
Apple investors lost money on the news. In fact, shares had their worst day since last August, down 4%. So let's find out more about what the alleged issues are and what might be the remedy for Apple and bring in one of the attorneys general behind the lawsuit. That is California Attorney General Rob Bonta. Attorney General Bonta, thanks for joining us. You recently settled with Google's Alphabet for, I think, $700 million. Google makes a phone. They make software, the Android platform. Why is that not competition enough for Apple to not be considered anti-competitive?
You know, it's based on the market share that they have. Apple has the biggest market share by far, 70% of the performance smartphone market, 65% of the smartphone market. So they are in a monopolistic position, and they are using that monopolistic position to abuse their power. They've created a moat around their kingdom, keeping customers locked in and blocking out other vendors and developers. And they're more than free to, in a competitive marketplace, use their business acumen and prevail on the merits. But they are not allowed under the law of the United States of America to abuse their power and use exclusionary and anti-competitive practices, which is what they're doing, which is why we brought the lawsuit today.
So can you go a little deeper, Attorney General, into the exclusions that they're doing? Is they're blocking developers or charging them too much? Is it because, as Merrick Garland said today, you get a green bubble when you text somebody who's on an Android platform? I mean, what exactly is the illegality on the exclusion side?
Well, it varies depending on the application, but here are a few. There's a product that people in California and across the country aren't that familiar with, called super apps, which have little apps inside them, like your messaging or your email or your banking. And those can be used across different platforms on different phones, but Apple blocks them from being used. They would be good for the consumer. They would be convenient. They would give consumers choice, potentially lower prices for consumers, but they are blocked. Another one is the digital wallet. On the Apple iPhone, you're allowed to use the digital wallet. You can pay using Tap to Pay, but if another bank, for example, had a digital wallet with a pay mechanism, they block the ability to do the Tap to Pay. And they go out of their way. It's deliberate. It's intentional. It's to create a competitive advantage, not because they're better, but just because they're using their monopolistic power. The green bubble versus blue bubble is another example. A green bubble in messaging means an iPhone is talking to an iPhone. You have all of the features. You can edit. You have the talking indicator. You can and put express emojis. When it's a blue bubble, you're talking to a Samsung or a Google, and it's deliberately deteriorated. Your pixels on your photos are worse and grainy. You have a worse quality video. You don't have the editing function or the talking indicator. And that's not because the Samsung or the Google product are worse. It's because Apple created those degradations and lower quality. They want you to think Samsung and Google are worse phones so that you buy an iPhone. So that is not allowed under antitrust law. Those are a few examples.
Can I just, California, my home state, I love it. It's got a lot of issues, though. Is this really the best use of taxpayer money?
We do it all. We walk and chew gum at the same time. This is a great use of taxpayer money. We're very efficient. We're working with the U.S. DOJ, 15 other states, bipartisan, multi-state effort, Republican and Democrats teaming up to protect consumers, give them lower prices, higher quality, more choice, more competition, mm-hmm. more innovation, and also to create opportunity for the next mom and pop, the next startup, the next dreamer and innovator and entrepreneur to have a chance at creating the next best thing, of being the next Apple or Meta or Google. But right now they're being prevented and excluded because of Apple's anti-competitive, illegal, exclusionary content.
Is there a number in your mind, Attorney General, that the good people of California might settle at, or does Apple have to take more action rather than just pay a gigantic, probably multi-billion dollar fine?
We've only asked in our request for a remedy for injunctive relief, no damages. We are asking for our costs and attorney's fees, but that's different than damages. We want the conduct to end. We want Apple to stop breaking the law. We want Apple to stop abusing its monopolistic power, stop being exclusionary and anti-competitive. That's the ask.
Attorney General Rob Bonta of California, we really appreciate you coming on, laying it out in a clear way. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You're very welcome. All right. So for all you youngins out there watching or listening, it's time for a little history lesson. Because this case against Apple does bring back some memories of 26 years ago, all the way back in May of 1998, when the Justice Department in 21 state and district attorney general filed a lawsuit against Microsoft. Here is then U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno from the press conference that fateful day.
The Justice Department has charged Microsoft with engaging in anti-competitive and exclusionary practices designed to maintain its monopoly in personal computer operating systems and attempting to extend that monopoly to internet browser software.
At the time, the DOJ argued that Microsoft bundling the Internet Explorer browser with Windows was unfair to competitors. It blocked them out. To give consumers more choice, it wanted Microsoft to also include the Netscape browser on Windows. Here's how then Microsoft CEO and founder Bill Gates responded that very same day on NBC Nightly News.
Microsoft did its very best to settle this dispute. We offered a lot of things that we thought were very creative. The fact that they were saying to us we had to jam that product into every copy of our thing, I think it's quite outrageous. There's certainly no basis for that in law. The only analogy I can think of is forcing Coke to put a six-pack of Pepsi in with every six-pack they offer.
Oh, remember that? All right. Well, nearly 2 years later, took 2 years, a federal judge ruled that Microsoft repeatedly violated antitrust laws. A months-long appeal process began, but it was largely upheld. The decision was. The DOJ eventually reversed course on wanting to break up Microsoft and ended up settling with the company. And as a result of the settlement, Microsoft had to share a lot of valuable information with other companies. But the damage was done. Microsoft stock was a dumpster fire for years, of course, also caught up in the internet collapse. But Microsoft actually fell 30% from 2000 until 2014. And the case also blew the door open for other tech competitors, including a then struggling California company called Apple. Apple shares were less than $1 a share in the year 2000. And now, 26 years later, the legal table has apparently turned as the government uses its immense power and unlimited resources to go after one of the world's most successful companies. Let's talk about that. Bring in Gene Munster of Deepwater Asset Management. I mean, Janet Reno, Tom Brokaw, Bill Gates when he was like 35. We're bringing it all back. But you get the broader point, Gene, which is that case, whether you agreed with it or not, did a lot of damage to Microsoft, and one wonders, we're not just randomly mentioning this, that maybe some people hate Apple for that green bubble. But do you think it will do that kind of long-lasting damage to the stock?
The simple answer is I don't, and for two reasons. Number one is the conversation today really orbits around two topics. One is the legality, and put that in the DOJ camp, and the other is the marketplace and consumer. And so when we think about what happened with Microsoft at the core, they had those 15 years in no man's land and down 30% because at the core they didn't innovate. That had nothing to do with sharing data with some competitors or unbundling or being forced to bundle Netscape. At the core, it was Microsoft's failure to innovate. And back to these two kind of core central topics. The DOJ is going to get what they want. They're going to force Apple to make some changes. Maybe it's the blue bubble gets ported over to Android. Maybe it makes it easier to shift from iPhone to Android. Maybe you can summon Shazam or other music services through your voice. But whatever that is, it doesn't change the most important point, which is what the consumer wants. And I believe that they will make changes. Apple's going to make changes, and consumers are still going to get what they want, which is the best product for the money, and that's Apple's products.
Yeah, and listen, I'm not sure I agreed with everything the attorney general was saying, but I will say this, and I'm not knocking Apple, but everybody out there watching or listening knows this, that once, and this goes to Google too, Gene, once you've sort of invested in the ecosystem, all your photos, all your music, all your apps, even if you really wanted to change, flip from Android to Apple or vice versa, you're probably not going to, because it's going to completely upend your phone's life and probably your life.
Exactly. But the DOJ, to that point, what they're proposing today is to make things like that 10, 15, 20% easier to do, to move your photos over, your contacts over between different devices. But that's not going to be enough. That just making it a little bit easier isn't going to change the fact that people's lives are centered on these devices. And I think this is going to be a topic that's going to weigh on Apple's multiple, because it's an easy target for investors to get concerned about. But I would say put your money on Apple's devices are going to stand on their innovation, and they're going to keep innovating.
One thing I worry about with Apple is, I'm not an investor in Apple, but I'm sure it's in, you know, I can own mutual funds through my 401k. I guarantee you Apple's in those. One thing I worry about is it feels like the government's going after Apple at a moment of a little bit of Apple weakness. And I only say that because the iPhone, you know, it's not really innovating that much. You know, the company feels like it's reached this inflection point on growth. Yeah, they've got the cool Vision Pro. That's probably still going to be a niche product. Is that a fair thing to say, or do you fundamentally disagree with what I just said?
I think there's two big events. I mean, there's a lot of events going on with Apple right now, but today I really looked at two events, the Department of Justice, and that kind of captured the day. But there's also Tim Cook being in China. And I think I was more nervous about Tim Cook being in China, because there's a reason why he's there. And it's not a good reason either. Number one, he's trying to get demand to be stronger for some of the complications they've had in China recently. Or number two, he's trying to smooth things over in anticipation of what could happen with TikTok and that ping pong ball. He doesn't want to get caught in the fallout from the geopolitical if that ends up getting banned. And so either one of those, that to me is fundamentals. It's more near term. It could be a punky quarter. It could be something that impacts the business for 6 months. But I think that I agree with you, is that Apple is going through a more difficult period here because things like what's going on in China, what's going on in the App Store. But ultimately, I think their customers will stick with them.
And they file the case on the day and the week that Tim Cook is in China and probably unable to respond. Gene Munster, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, coming up, Peter Diamandis on the upcoming abundance from AI. Some very good news ahead. Plus, a housing market stunner that seems like good news, but is a little more than meets the eye. Bess Friedman, up with that next. RBI is dedicated to all you single folks out there, because new rankings are out listing the salaries that a single person needs to live comfortably, I'm doing air quotes if you're on the radio, in America's biggest cities. And since you're probably asking, what does comfortable mean? Well, here's the criteria that was used by Smart Asset. It means you got a 50-30-20 budget. That's 50% of your income can pay for things like housing and food, 30% to discretionary spending or things you want, and 20% set aside for savings or investment. So Smart Asset ranked the five priciest areas. You want to live like that, 50, 30, 20. Here are the five most expensive metro areas for you to do that in. Number five, Boston. Beantown, a single person needs to make $125,000 to be, quote, comfortable, shifting to the West Coast, where it costs a little more to make it in Santa Ana, California. Great airport, by the way. Same goes for nearby Irvine, also very expensive. It is Orange County, California, after all. And California is where we stay, because let's go north to San Jose, where you need to make about $10,000 more per year up north than down south. You need to make about $137,000 a year. But the city with the highest salary needed for a single person to be comfortable is, it's not hard, New York. A whopping $138,000 a year is what you're going to need to be comfortable if you do not have a significant other. But this kind of doomy list, it's hard to make that kind of money, particularly when you're young, got us thinking. Where could a single person thrive in a very cool big city on a reasonable salary? Well, Smart Asset looked at 99 metro areas, and the winner is where we just came from, Houston, Texas, where if you make $75,000 a year, you can have decent lodging. You can have some fun. You can even save some money. You got great restaurants, absolutely nice people, and pretty good weather, at least, like, not for June, July, and August, but the other 9 months are beautiful. So apparently everything is not bigger in Texas. Random, but interesting. All right, speaking of housing, some good news, sorta, on the real estate front. Sales of existing homes spiking nearly 10% last month, the biggest monthly jump in a year. Yay. But there's a big money caveat. The biggest jumps came from the sales of homes that cost more than $1 million. Look at that. There's almost no movement, or maybe even a contraction, on homes that are under $250K. So how do we really read this data? Well, let's get a read on real estate right now with Brown Harris Stephens CEO, Bess Friedman. Bess, and I got to imagine something you and I have talked about is going on here, which is that those homes over a million, they're probably not being bought with a mortgage. They're all cash. So interest rates be damned.
Probably. I mean, I think there's a little bit of that. And there's a lot of pent up demand. So I think it's various different things. You know, inventory, we're starting to see more of that come on the market. But I think it's the economy, too. I mean, the economy has proven to be very resilient. I think we are in that soft landing. Inflation is down. People are feeling better. Wall Street is happy. And buyers or sellers and sellers are getting back into the market. So, you know, we're in a better place now than we were even 6 months ago. And we saw that the Fed is probably going to cut the Fed fund rate this summer. So we're happy about that. But, you know, yeah. I think it's, as they say, it's the economy, stupid. I think the economy is in a good place, in a better place than we thought.
Well, as Beck, the singer Beck said, where it's at is two turntables and a microphone. But apparently where it's at in real estate is still at the high end. What do we need to do to get the rest of it moving? I understand there's not a lot of supply. A lot of people just aren't moving. They're locked into 3% mortgages. They're done. The president's offering, you know, a couple thousand dollars to try to incentivize people to sell or buy. Is that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I think people are already getting into the market. You know, sellers have started to get into the market. We're seeing a pickup in inventory, and buyers are starting to get into the market because people have started to accept the fact that mortgage rates are going to be around 6 or 7%, and they're probably going to go down a little bit. We're not going to see the 2 and 3% for who knows when. So I think people who need to buy and need to sell are going to do so because housing is essential. So we're seeing a little bit more momentum, and I think that's a really good thing for us.
Are people that sensitive to rates? I mean, 6.5 versus 7, you know, it's a 0.5%, but it sounds like you're saying that gets people's, you know, sort of, it gets them into action.
I mean, it has gotten them into action. And I think people initially, I mean, there was a lot of uncertainty last year. We were hearing that we could enter a recession. Inflation wasn't where it needed to be, you know, all of those sorts of things. But now there is much more certainty in the market, which has inspired people to get back into it, which is a great thing for us. So I think it's incremental. We feel that we're in a very steady place in housing. Mm-hmm. And we only think things will get better. That's what we're saying. We think things will get better.
All right. Well, we did this segment because the data. The next time we have you on, Bess, which hopefully will be soon, we're going to talk about these likely changes to commissions. But that's for another segment. We'll get to that. Okay. Bess Friedman, thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. You're welcome. All right. In the meantime, call it a small cap comeback. The Russell 2000 index up 3% in just the last week. And the strategist who called last year's October rally sees it going even higher, way higher. If you missed it last night, we forgive you. But here's a monster call on small caps from strategist Tom Lee on Last Call last night.
Means with the Fed doing a dovish pause and CEOs getting more confident, and that means M&A and IPOs and people looking at other sectors, I do think the Russell can rise 50% this year.
Wow. Tom seeing a 50% gain across that index because he thinks a lot of small cap stocks are just simply really, really undervalued. And so does your next guest. Joining us now is Aldra, Executive VP and Fund Manager Amy Zen. She is named a top 2024 fund manager by Morningstar, among many other awards. And Amy, we always love having you on because you bring these companies in these stocks that at least I myself have never heard of. But before that, on a macro level, what do you make of Tom Lee's very bold call?
Great to see you, Brian. Yes, I totally agree in the sense, I mean, I don't know if it's every stock is going to go 50%, but I think this should be a very strong comeback year for small cap. As you know, small cap has been in a bear market for almost 3 years. And in terms of valuation, the valuation gap is very, very big. A truck can drive through it. I'll tell you why. currently, you know, S&P 500 versus S&P 600 small cap growth, the small cap growth index is trading at 22% discount to the S&P 500. And historically, for the last 20 years, it's been trading at a premium of 14%. So you can see why, you know, the just for reversion to mean alone, we'll have a lot of catch up to do in small cap.
Let's get down into some of the individual names that you like. Because one of the things I like to do with my son is go to these revolving sushi restaurants where they have the conveyor belt and then you kind of look at what's on there. I had no idea. I'm not bringing this up to talk about my dining habits. I'm bringing it up because I had no idea that there was a publicly traded company that is the leader in this booming trend. It's called Kura Sushi. It's based in California. You love the stock.
Yes, actually, you can go to the Edison location because I think you're Princeton, right?
I have.
Yeah. And it's a very special company. As you know, it's a tech-enabled sushi chain concept. And as you know, how much, you know, automation is very important, you know, in everything we invest. And for Kura Sushi, they really, because they have robots, you know, what deliver drinks for you. And also they have machines that can do part of the preparation for the rice preparation for sushi. And in the near future, they're also rolling out, you know, dishwashing robots and sushi robots to do part of the, you know, rice preparation. So. Yep. So you could see that really gives them a significant competitive advantage, you know, with that moat for the brand that enables them to really scale profitably. So that's number one. Number two is that, you know, it's a very fragmented market that, you know, sushi industry, I think as a food category is about $28 billion. And Kura Sushi, the revenue is less than $200 million. As you know, that's very important to us because it's less than 1% penetration. So it's a long runway for growth. Currently, they only have 60 locations and we think they can grow to 500 plus locations. Last but not least, it's really a good bang for the buck. That's very important for all our companies. You know, when we look at consumer names that, you know, the for a plate is about $3.50. So that's at least 50% cheaper than mainstream sushi. So you can see that's why it's a very strong value proposition for consumers.
We love you bringing the names. And I'm not advocating for the restaurant at all because there's competitors. But when you see that robot come around the corner for the first time with your drinks on it, it's kind of cool. It's a little creepy.
Very cool.
But we love the name. Amy, do not be a stranger because you got so many original names. Let's get you back on very soon. We've got a lot of news tonight, but we're going to let you go, but we're going to get you on soon again and talk about some of these other names. Amy Zan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, be well. All right, coming up, boomers versus doomers, the new AI debate playing out in California. You're going to hear from famed entrepreneur Peter Diamandis, but only if you stick around. All right, welcome back. The Abundance 360 Summit is wrapping up today following a four-day exploration of AI and other big future technologies with a large focus on maybe the great AI debate, boomers versus doomers. With us tonight for more is Abundance 360 founder and serial entrepreneur Peter Diamandis. The conference looked amazing. Maybe next year we'll get an invite. Peter, I mean, you know, I was in California about 4 days ago. What was the, to you, I saw some amazing things. Thank you. I saw that's how I do it. I just kind of barge in. What was kind of the biggest, most aha moment from your four-day event?
So we had the top AI experts there from Eric Schmidt, Ray Kurzweil, Elon Musk, Jeff Jeffrey Hinton. And the conversation wasn't just about reaching artificial general intelligence, human level AI. We're basically there. It was what happens on this exponential growth curve when AI is not as smart as us, but a million or a billion times smarter than us, right? There's no artificial limit at human intelligence. You know, double something 20 times, it's a million times better, 30 times, it's a billionfold. So the conversation was on this great AI debate we held amongst these, you know, 600 CEOs and philanthropists and leaders was, is AI or digital superintelligence our greatest hope for humanity or our greatest existential threat?
And that's a pretty big darn question, Peter.
It is.
Is it going to save humanity or kill us?
Yeah, I mean, and guess what? We need to be having this conversation at our dinner tables, in our boardrooms, in our halls of Congress, and so forth, because it's not 20 years away or 10 years away. This is the next 5 years. I think no one truly has an understanding of how fast this is going. You know, Elon was there speaking about it and saying, we're seeing a 10x increase in AI compute every 6 months. So that's massive, right? Anthropic hit 101 IQ on its third, on Claude 3. We have Gemini 1.5 doing amazing. And so there's no limiting factor, and they're continuing. And so one of the gentlemen there, Mo Gadot, who wrote an amazing book, Scary Smart, talks about the notion that we're raising Superman, right? So Clark Kent lands in Kansas, and he's trained by ethical, moral parents to become a superhero. But if he had landed in the wrong place, you know, and became a drug dealer, would he become a supervillain? So we're giving birth to this new species on this planet, this AI. How we raise it is so important.
I think how we raise people is also so important. Peter, I want to move on. Neuralink. Yeah. Neuralink recently shared a video of its first human patient to get its implant. And really, this gentleman who was paralyzed from the neck down used Neuralink and his mind to control a computer. I mean, it's powerful stuff. Hopefully it'll change this gentleman's life for the better. Is this kind of what you're talking about?
And this is just the beginning. We had Elon speaking about this. Ray Kurzweil, who's one of the greatest predictors, he predicted human-level AI this decade. His prediction on high bandwidth, connecting the cloud to your brain at high bandwidth links, 2033, right? So 9 years from now. And the idea is, I hate to say this, Elon's words, not mine, if you can't beat them, join them. As AI is taking off, are we going to couple with it? Now, these are incredibly insane ideas. But guess what? If you tried to describe to someone living 100 years ago our lives today, it would be incredibly insane. And the speed of acceleration means in the next 10 years, we're going to see as much progress as we've seen in the last 100 years.
Wow.
It's a challenge.
I think it is an amazing, I know we got a lot of problems, but I think it's an amazing time to be alive. And like Jack Kerouac said, you know, you want to live with the mad ones, right? The ones that are a little bit out there, because they're the ones that may not always, but can change the world. Yeah. Look forward to having you back on again soon, Peter, and look forward to coming out there next year. Thank you. Just inviting myself in, folks. Coming up, the utterly bizarre scandal rocking baseball's highest paid player, Joe Pomp. That next. Welcome back. Baseball season starts next Thursday, but a bit of a scandal is overshadowing its highest paid star, the Dodgers' Shohei Ohtani. Joining us now is an investor at Pomp Investment, sports business analyst Joe Pompliano. And Joe, if the viewers don't know, it has to do with Shohei Ohtani, his interpreter, a gambling debt. And it's a weird story. People can go read the story for themselves. But what makes it weirder and gets your sort of radar up is that the story's already changed. What do you make of this?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian. I think that's exactly it. No one really knows what to think about this because the story has changed so many times and the details are still relatively unknown. But to backtrack a little bit here, essentially what's happening is there's a bookmaker, an illegal bookmaker being investigated by the FBI in Southern California. In those files, it was found by ESPN and the LA Times that Ohtani had paid $4.5 million to this bookmaker under his name from his account. He wired the money. So they started asking questions. Why did he do this? His representatives told them that he was covering a gambling debt for his interpreter. His interpreter confirmed that story. And then once that was confirmed by his interpreter, the story all of a sudden changed. And now Ohtani knew nothing about it, and it was this massive theft. So I think people are just trying to figure out whether Ohtani knew about it, whether Ohtani was potentially gambling, or was he just potentially being a good friend and covering his debts.
Wait, the middle one, and there's no allegations, I want to be clear, but because the story did change, there are people that are suggesting if, it's a big if, we're not saying anything, but if Ohtani was the one gambling and his interpreter's taking the fall, he's done. Ohtani's done. He's Pete Rosed.
Yeah, I think there's a couple important things here. Number one, there was no bets on baseball, so at least that's a good thing, right? I still don't think that it's good in the grand scheme of things, but hopefully that can help baseball fans sleep a little bit better at night. But number two, and one of the real reasons why I think people are concerned about this is there's no bookie in the world that would give someone a $4.5 million line of credit if you're only making $300,000 to $500,000 a year. So whether the bookie knew that Ohtani was backstopping the losses or whether the interpreter told him that, it was explicitly known that someone else was covering his losses.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, I don't know how you run up that kind of debt being on an interpreter's salary, because you probably don't. Joe Pomp, I'm sure there's more to come on this story. Thank you very much. All right, folks, thank you for watching Last Call. We'll see you tomorrow night. CNBC Leaders with NVIDIA CEO and founder is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, package-less and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.